Welcome to Brick Talk Live, the podcast where we dive deep into the world of masonry restoration and the people who are preserving history brick by brick. I'm your host, Gillian Lancaster, and today I have two incredible gentlemen with me who've been at the forefront of restoring and preserving some of the most beautiful historic buildings in Texas and beyond. Joining us is Alan Pattingill, a masonry restoration specialist with over 30 years of experience, and Benchmark Harris, a highly respected structural engineer and expert in the challenges of historic structures. These two have known each other for almost two decades and have shared an extraordinary journey in their careers. Alan, Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Morning, Gillian. How are you doing, my dear? Good to talk to you as always.
Lovely. Thank you. Morning, Ben. Thank you for coming.
Hello, hello.
I know you've both served on technical committees for the Masonry Society over the decades, but I want to go back to the beginning.
Oh, me and Ben. I remember Ben. I gave a presentation at the Structural Engineers Association of Texas many, many moons ago, and it was on a new subject that was cavity wall tie replacement. I'd come over from England, and I was trying to show all of the problems that we have in England and hopefully trying to educate over here, but come to realise that once I got over here, you certainly wasn't in Kansas anymore, Toto. The buildings changed.
That's not when we met.
Where did we meet then? TMS?
We met at TMS.
No, before that.
CMS. No, we did not. I would have remembered if I had heard you give that presentation. I know about your presentation. It made waves. We talked about your presentation. But no, it was Jason Thompson introduces me to you, and he says, hey, you're both in Texas.
Oh, yeah.
And I looked at you and said, where are you in Texas? He said, oh, you know, north of Dallas. I said, well, hello, my new friend.
We'll have to get together.
And the rest was history. And this was over two decades ago.
Yeah,
right?
It was.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember one of our main projects, the first projects we ever went on, well, one of them was on a school where we did an investigation on cavity wall ties. And it was luckily enough that I'd brought a lot of equipment from England. So we started sharing different techniques of surveying.
Well, that's a very generous way of putting it. You taught me. You taught me how to do surveying, right? I mean, don't get me wrong. I wasn't born yesterday, right? So I know in general what we're looking for, but most structural engineers were like me back then, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you tackle this problem?
That's right.
And you're bringing out the mirrors and the point focus and metal detectors and the chalk
and the endoscope and metal detectors and how to remove bricks.
Oh, yeah. And laser precision of one brick right here and then color matching the mortar.
Yeah.
I mean, Julie, have you ever seen like the work that he's done? Have you ever like seen
photos, but I haven't seen it in real life.
It's amazing. I mean, you're an artist. We did this one project for a university in the north of Dallas, Fort Worth area, and they had some cast stone. You remember this?
Oh,
cast stone?
Yeah.
And so, you know, so the cast stone is coming off, right?
Right.
Done a lot of projects together, so I'm sure this whole if you're hoping this is going to be a 30 minute presentation, this is probably going to take 3 hours, but the cast stone was coming off, and so Al and I are looking at it, you know, and Al takes a couple cores to see what's going on, and there were you know, of course, after you take the cores, you put them back, well, there's that little ring that he filled in with mortar. And so he matches it perfectly to the, you know, the kind of moldy black color. And then we did this whole, Al did this whole restoration project. I was engineer on it. And then after it was done, they were so impressed. It looked so beautiful. They power washed all of it. And what you saw were these black circles where he had perfectly matched before they power washed.
So I had to go back up and then dye them back again. We matched it to existing. We weren't ready for them cleaning it all up and getting it back to original.
But anyway, I mean, that was on that first job. Was it? Did I see this before you were brought in, or did you and I see it together? Do you remember over the opening?
Yeah, it was
with the 10-foot by 10-foot masonry panel.
That's right.
That had one tie.
Yes,
and then there were expansion joints on each side.
Yeah.
And we were both looking at each other like,
How's it standing up?
The breeze would blow this thing over. What it was, Gillian, I don't know how much you know about masonry, but you know expansion joints, the vertical lines with the caulk in them, it's supposed to not have anything behind it, right? The masonry is supposed to breathe. Brick expands, right? And so it was all because there was mortar. There was no expansion joint. It was all brick. So much mortar, that's what was holding the thing together.
That's it. Oh, it just didn't fall
It had
off.
one tie, Julian, one tie right in the middle.
People
I
going
think that.
underneath this to get in and out of the building.
Oh, yeah, this is a school
Oh my
building.
goodness.
And we've covered schools, we've covered historical as well. In fact, I remember one time we was on an historic church.
Oh,
That was challenging as
So
well.
I remember being on this boom lift, and so Al has all this equipment. One of this equipment, I don't know what you call it, where it has two
Arbitech.
Abatech, two
The
sliding.
Arbitech cutting
How would we
block,
describe that to the audience here? Two
Well,
sliding
it's like a meat
blades.
slicer that you'd cut a turkey with, except that it slices the mortar between the brick.
So it can slice out a mortar
Yeah,
joint. It's
that's right.
perfect.
Really well, good way of doing
So we're
it.
doing this with some cast stone, and you remember the whole thing
Yeah,
starts
starting and moving.
vibrating.
And I looked at Ben, and it was funny because I said to Ben, I said, "I've always got a golden rule. If I start running, you start running." And we both looked at each other and realized we was in a boom lift going,
Maybe we don't touch this one
let's not
anymore.
play with this anymore. But some of the things is that with the challenges that we do come across, especially with historical buildings, you certainly don't know what you're getting into a lot of times until you do start digging deeper. And that's when the challenges with a contractor and engineer have to work together to come up with an idea of how to get in and repair these things. It's not just there's new build and then there's old. So it's like working with an old car. When your granddad says, "Can you go outside, son, and fix me car?" Of course I
Well,
can.
that's really what you're talking about is really what the spirit of the Masonry Society was formed
Yeah. I
to
was going
be.
to ask you about that, yes.
The old logo, I don't know if people remember, or at least I don't know if it was when just when the first one I went to, the North American Masonry Conference, but it was three arches. And they were like the arch
That's
that a
right.
contractor would draw, and the arch that an engineer would draw, and the arch that an architect would draw, basically, is how you could look at it. And you get the AEC perspective. That's what's so great. I've had so many friendships that have come from TMS, and other code committees that we've been on, and all the years together,
I think that as well as what Ben said about with the Masonry Society, when I first got there, was certainly there's a lot of academics. But one of the things is that they understood that me coming from a contractor role and having a lot of experience and sharing the knowledge, they were willing to learn and listen and understand. So when I needed to expand my horizons, they taught me how to do that. And certainly with papers, presentations, although don't have Ben Harris around if you're ever going to give a presentation at the Masonry Society.
Do you know what he's talking about, Julie?
No, I don't.
No.
What did you do?
So I had a
Go on, you
okay.
take it.
So I had a cup of coffee, right? And the conference wall had this one. It was like a 2 foot opening that everybody had to pass through, like 800 of people or plus, for this conference. And they're all trying to get the coffee service and come back to their
And
seats.
I'm getting ready to go up on stage, so I'm
You wouldn't
nervous.
believe it. He was in a three-piece suit. He was in a three-piece suit.
I was looking rather dapper. I won't deny. However, once Ben come round the corner and hit me with a coffee, I've got a white shirt on. The white shirt gets soaked in coffee. I looked at Ben and everybody in the room went, "He's going to kill it." And I went, "I can't believe this. I'm sweating already and panicking about going on stage because this was in front of my peers."
I was just trying to get your mind
Yeah,
off
well, it worked. It worked
Good
because I was
distraction
thinking, oh,
technique.
So up to the hotel room I go, took my shirt off, washed it as fast as I could, put it on. And then I had to get a hairdryer to dry my shirt out as best I can. Well, you can imagine my internal core was already going and sweating because I'm panicking
But you
about,
did great.
yeah, oh, now you don't, it's smart talking, mate.
It
So
gave
then
you
I had
something
to
else
cut.
to focus on.
And when I come back down, everybody's there going, "Oh, I hope this goes well."
I swear, when that happened, I looked at you, and all I could see, Jillian, was if it was any other person, you would have just decked
That
them.
was it.
Just like.
This is happening. Well, one of the things is that with the Masonry Society and why I'm glad to be a part of it is that they've certainly opened the doors to look at contractors and things down the line and share the knowledge and work it. And I think that down the line, where they're looking at changing codes, building codes, it's going to be relevant for a lot of people out there in communities. So it's been an interesting learning curve. And as I said, with Ben, We do. We're still a part of it. We've grown up and we moved on. I'm still involved in some of the codes. Ben's still involved with some of the other aspects of the Masonry
Society. Well, I mean, my whole association with the National Storm Shelter Association came from my association with TMS.
Yeah.
Right? Because, you know, got wind of it in 2013 when the 2015 IBC code change had taken place. A lot of people don't realize the codes change years in advance of them being published. And it takes years for them to get adopted, you know? And so, yeah, so the NSSA, all of my involvement with there came from my involvement with TMS, where I was asked to speak about Masonry storm shelters and other storm shelters, you know, being that we practice in the zone where they're required, you know. So it goes. But you know, one of the questions you asked, Jillian, was about, you know, when we first met. And, you know, that the reason we first met is, I think, interesting. And that is, you referred to it earlier. It's that Tom Grimm, who has passed away.
Yes.
Great man.
Tom Grimm, what a man.
Great man. I went to University of Texas at Austin for my undergraduate. And so Rich Klingner was a professor there. And Rich eventually was the chair of the TMS 402, which a lot of people know is the national standard for, you know, masonry design for new construction. Right.
Good man, yeah.
Al, you met Tom Grimm separately from me.
Yeah.
And then of course I met Tom, but really my association was Rich, which was his protege.
Yes.
You know, of course, you know, Rich had his own career path, but in many ways they were colleagues about masonry as
Johnny
Tom Grimm,
Mathis, Miller,
Tom Grimm passed the baton, you know, basically teaching that subject to Rich. And one of the things, this is related to masonry restoration, right? I'm going to try, Jillian, as much as possible to tie it back to what we're supposed to be talking about, is Rich would always talk about, I remember he would say, the Communist Manifesto of Structural Engineering. Have you ever heard this?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So it's everything in proportion to its stiffness. All right. And so I remember, and it's so true. It is so true when it comes to these, like, how many times have we looked at a cookie that's crumbling?
Yeah.
And it's okay. Flip over here. It's connected over here. And that's why it's cracking, you know?
Yeah.
And I was as a guy who just graduated interviewing for a job. And I hadn't even gotten the job yet up in North Texas. I remember the guy who became my boss, looking at a, you know, series of arches in an old university that some masonry had fallen off from cast stone. Actually, it was not cast stone. It was real stone. Limestone had fallen off. The cast iron anchors had rotated slightly.
Ooh.
And it's like, well, you know, that whole concept of everything in proportion to its stiffness, once you start thinking of it that way, you realize that's where the crack patterns form and that's where the stresses are, you know. So, but interestingly enough, Tom Grimm and I, and do you know about the Grimm Mathis Library?
So
Dr. Mathis at UT Arlington, where I got my master's, Dr. Mathis inherited all of Tom Grimm's library, which is like 14 full bookshelves, because this is back in the day, Jillian. This was with the dot matrix printers and he would catalog lovingly, and he would make copies, and he had his own little periodical index. Uh-huh. And so when I did my master's thesis research, I had the privilege of being able to go through the one and only real library of its kind in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was recognized by the Royal British.
Oh, everybody.
You know, Canadians, the British Society,
Canadians, everybody around
very
the
world. Very prolific writer. And at the day, in the day when you didn't have the internet or anything like that.
He wrote more papers than anybody else. And the good thing is that because I went to his house and I got to know him, at the end when I left, he gave me a big folder of all his papers and said, you're going to need these down the line. And he wasn't joking. And inside, there was a paper handwritten from him. And he said, Alan, it was so good to see you. I hope these help you out in the future. All cataloged.
Well, for anyone who may be interested, that whole library, including Dr. Mathis's content, there's actually a few things in there for me, but that's minor. That all has gone to Acme Brick.
Wow.
So anybody who wants to see those references, if there's any, you know, undergraduate or graduate students looking to do a paper, you know, that's a great resource, but I think you have to go in person.
I think the thing is, one of the things you said about Acme Brick has been at the forefront of remediation, helping me over the years, finding different colours and different bricks, things like that. The office out of Denton, where you were, I spent a lot of my time up there with Jennifer Mars and a few other people. Absolutely great, but they're a good outfit, and they do care about brick and masonry. I'll give that about Acme. They really do.
Well, the fact that they've got this academic material there means that they're serious about it.
Yeah, big time. And the thing is, that having all that information down the line, I'm looking forward to when AI one time will be able to pick it up and re-ramp some of the stuff and take it forward for education.
And you know what's interesting about restoration of masonry is that it's not a big dollar topic, right? And the world of new construction codes, they change constantly. You have a lot of people very interested in that topic because there's a lot of masonry construction that happens, new construction. But preservation is a whole other world. It moves at a much slower rate, and it doesn't. The technology doesn't change every day. It changes, but it doesn't change every day. No. So stuff even that old is actually quite relevant, you know?
Well, it is. And I think that it wasn't until I got to America and I was sitting down in America and having gone with Ben about some of the small old towns, because when we first got together, we ended up going down to a town called Brownsville. I got involved down there with some masonry restoration, and I asked Ben if he'd come with me one time. So we got really into a lot of historic buildings and things like this. But one thing that I realized about America is almost split into two groups of masonry. You've got the 1850s, 1860s to 1910 that was all constructed with lime-based mortar. Yep. And most of America was built on a kit that you ordered, and it was brought to site, and then you had a local mason with some local bricks build it. But it wasn't the Portland cement. Didn't come about till the 1900 with the railways. So it wasn't until after that that a lot of buildings were adapted differently using a masonry veneer system over studs and things like that. So the old historic buildings downtown were never put in the equation. And to be honest, I remember discussing with Ben over a beer one time, and I said, do you think the old forefathers said, hey, don't worry, in 100 years my building will still be standing, so don't worry about it. Whereas nowadays, one of the hardest things for us to do is to go back to those old days and try and find any information, because at least with a new build, you've got some plans and drawings.
Yeah, so in my family, all four of my grandparents, their families had engineers in the history.
Get out of here.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, no wonder. You know, that's it then. Now I understand the addiction.
And one of them gave me his two really valuable references that were, you know, on his desk. One was a civil engineer's handbook, and I forget the other title. Miriam Kidder Parker, I think Kidder Parker maybe is, I forget the name of it. But it's a fascinating reference of the world, you know, of his day. Yeah. I don't know if you know who Terzaghi is, but no. he's like, you know, one of the fathers of geotechnical engineering.
Right.
And he knew Terzaghi, you know, and did everything with the slide rule and hard cross. My grandfather, that book was really helpful. And I remember showing you some of the pages from the mercantile buildings, what
that's
they called
right.
it, right?
Yes.
You know, it's about like a 30 foot wide by, you know, 110 foot, 120 foot long rectangular building, single, maybe two story, maybe three story. And you just see them stacked side by side, you know, and all around those, especially like in Texas and a lot of America.
Yes.
You know, a lot of people don't realize that in California, you have so many, you know, people and building officials and structural engineers. You focus on seismic, but that's a world apart from really the rest of the United States.
Well, it is when you get down in some of the squares in Texas, and you get down and you realize you are literally in the wild, wild
west.
I mean, some of them can be ghost towns, some of them can be different, but it's a culture all of its own, and it's amazing. I'm lucky enough to have kept going over the years and done teaching workshops with Texas Historical Commission and different things, and it's just fascinating from an outsider looking in. But one good thing about coming from England, Jill, was that when I came from England, I brought a lot of skill set from the British that had done a lot of retrofit and showed how it worked and things. So we're on the cutting edge and things like that. But eventually, America is starting to come around where it's looking at from different countries around the world, how they're fixing things and what we need to change to make a better life. Because a lot of buildings, some are built absolutely great. And on the other hand, we know, wow, yeah, that's scary.
Was that what helped you bring about the historic masonry workshop you did in Brownsville between you?
Well, yeah, it was, because one of the things is that I'd worked on historical buildings, and Ben came down and he realized very quickly, you need help, big boy. Plus, it was interesting. And we went down there and we met a wonderful woman called Marion Sanchez in Brownsville, Texas. And the thing was, is that when we were down there, we realized we needed to come back. So when we came back, we're driving back, which was a long drive. We had a lot of chance to talk about it. And then I said to Ben, why don't we go back and take some of the boys and why don't we do a workshop?
Yeah.
And Ben went, you know what? That's not a bad idea. So we reached out to Michael Schuller. He's our Indiana Jones of masonry. And then we reached out to Andreas Stavadis, a professor, wonderful gentleman from Greek, and Gordon Shepherd asked him to come out and help us as well, out of Apollo Engineering in Houston. Great engineers. And we went down there and we did it off the cuff, and it was one of the most amazing things that I've ever been involved with. It worked well. It was informative. It was 6.5 hours. But on the upside to it, after we gave the presentation, we went back down on the beach and we were all fishing in the water, up to our neck in water, having a few beers, running around like big kids. And I'm not kidding you, they say that engineers haven't got a sense of humor. Get them with a few beers in them and get them fishing.
But what a day of fishing, you remember?
Oh,
the great tarpon migration.
It was just amazing.
So, Jillian, so I don't go fishing nearly as much as this guy, right?
Right.
So I'm walking, and when you walk, the first foot of water, you know, just like half an inch deep was just chock full of these little fish.
Yeah.
And then they get bigger, and they're like in bands, and they get just bigger. But they are like as if someone drained an aquarium to like 1/10 of what it originally had, right? All the sea life is just packed in there.
Yeah.
And then we're stepping on fish as we're – I was like, is this Jesus Christ in the second coming?
Walk on top of that.
Like something's going down. Something of biblical proportions is going down. Man, I mean, I would not believe myself if someone were to hear me. But I mean, it's true. You hear a lot of fisher stories. This is absolutely true. And then in the waves, you could see
the fish,
these like 3 foot white with the yellow back, you know,
just flying tarpon through.
And Al's hooking them, and then they're biting through the wires of the hooks.
Yeah, they were that strong. And I'm not kidding you, but when we was in the water, the thing was the fish were coming through chasing the smaller fish. I remember getting hit in the side with a couple of them.
Yeah.
I thought I'd been punched.
They were jumping between. They were jumping between us. Yeah. We're jumping.
And I remember one of the guys, he saw Finn go by a little bit further out, and he said, "What's that?" I said, "I hope it's a porpoise."
At which point you all retreated to the shore.
But the point is that one thing that I realized about it was that workshop. We were able to take the workshop down the line. And it was a friend of mine at the TMS, Susan Shurer. She helped us get it in to the Tom Grimm scholarship. So all of the videos and the money from that went to the Tom Grimm scholarship. So
it's posted on the TMS website,
it's
right?
It's
and you can get like CEUs.
Yes. That's wonderful.
You can get CEUs.
Like 6.5 hours.
And all the boys that were involved had something to do. Like Mike Shuler was a part of Tom Grimm. So was Ben.
You remember Scoochie Gucci?
Yeah.
Do you know what Scoochie Gucci means?
No.
Okay, so this is, you know, like Gucci, like the handbag?
Yes, the brand, yes.
That means like, I think that means like zip in Italian.
Yeah.
And so Mike was telling everybody, Shuler was telling everybody that he was working on some project in Italy. You know, Mike, right?
Yeah, Indiana Jones.
And when you tell them to like take every other brick out of, you know, as they go back and forth. So it's a zigzag pattern. So you unzip and zip. So Scoochie Gucci is how you say unzip and zip. And like, oh, Gucci.
The one thing as well is that when we were down there as well, because Andreas, he's from Lesbos, he's from Greece, and he's got the bestest sense of humor. He's such a lovely man. And we all had our subjects. Mine were a bit off the cuff. Ben's was all there doing codes and different things, lateral straight anchors. But we offered an insight of what can be done when a collaboration of good friends get together. with a mad idea. And we're talking about doing another one down the line in Texas one time for the small towns, because they need all the help they can get.
So when we toured that town, just to give you an idea of what it's like to spend a day with Al. So we're down there. I think this was the first trip down.
Yeah.
And so we're touring with Marion and the local owners of historic buildings.
That's right. Yeah, and the mayor and everything.
It was a crew.
It was there.
And so we go, let me see if I get the order right. We go to this historic bar.
Yes.
And then we see, where the people had for, 100 plus years had wetting their whistle and then we go
to a historic jail.
No, but we didn't get to the horse jail yet. Okay. It was to a historic historic brothel.
That's correct.
Now,
I do want to be clear. This was not an operating brothel.
No.
All right. In the
past. It was down by a bus station, and the building was in disrepair. Yeah. That's why they wanted us
That's
to
what
look
they wanted
at
us
it.
To look.
All right.
It just so happened that the proprietors before had a different use than normal. That's the best way
Then after going to a bar and then a brothel, we went to a historic jail. That's when we went
correct.
To a historic jail.
The oldest jail, one of the old historic jails.
And then we went to a historic courthouse.
That's
and
right.
We saw the refurbishment that had happened there.
Yeah.
Right? And then we went to the historic cathedral.
Yeah, you took me to church.
So we went to a bar, to a brothel, to a jail, to a courthouse, and to the church.
And a cathedral.
Basically,
all in one day. All in one day, yeah, I must admit. And it was funny because I was saying, well, I'm not going to go there because I'm from the Church of England. And Ben said, it's okay, I've got a VI pass. I've got a Catholic church, it can come with me. So we ended up in there. And what a beautiful cathedral.
Oh, Jillian, so you would walk in and you would see this perfect Gothic arch of the ceiling, okay?
Beautiful.
And it looks just like stucco. You know what stucco is, right? Okay, yeah, cementitious stucco.
Yeah.
But not a crack in it. And
nope.
And we're talking to the people because, Al and I can get anywhere. We can get with the business card, Al just being Al, just
an accident, right?
So the guys are telling us that it's basically mud and sticks and bubble gum and duct tape or whatever they had in the day, and they would shape canvas. It's painted canvas.
Yes.
It's shaped canvas.
Beautiful.
So it looks like mint condition stucco Gothic masonry ceiling,
It looks like almost a Greek ceiling. Yeah.
Oh.
But they got ravaged. One of the things about Brownsville is that they used to speak five different languages down there in the day, because so many people came from around the world, the Dutch, the Scottish. There was all kinds, Spanish, Irish, all kinds
Six
of people.
Six Flags of Texas, right?
Six Flags of Texas way back in the day. But
it's every hurricane that gushes across the Gulf of Mexico.
Two had really done some serious damage in the past. But the point being is that down there on the border, it was amazing. And to see the Spanish style and Texas style, West Texas, to see the West Texas style, you certainly knew that you weren't in Kansas anymore. And we've certainly dealt with a lot of beautiful old historic buildings and had the chance to go down there and be involved in the community and give back as well, which, as I said, the main person out of all of that I'd love to thank again and again is Marion Sanchez. What an amazing lady. She cares about that town so much and has been so there for everybody else.
Were they the most impressive projects you've come across? Ben, what's the most impressive restoration project you've come across?
I don't know how to answer that question. They're all so different.
They're all, aren't they? I mean, if a church can be impressive, a university can be impressive.
Okay, so the most surprising ones. How about that? Is it impressive? The most surprising.
All of them.
I would say there are surprising things that have happened. I mean, Al, you've got your snake story.
The snake going up the side of the wall. That was an English one. The boys were saying, you can't give this presentation while we're down there thinking. I said, I have to, because I'm English. And what it was a friend of mine came over and we were going to go fishing to Brazil. And I said, look, I've got to go look at this building. So when we got there, he'd only just got off the plane from England. And when we walked around, he saw something. He says, hey, look. He said, is that a snake? I said, yeah, come away. And he said, is it dead? And I said, leave it. So he can't leave it back. And he got a stick and he poked it. Nope, it wasn't dead. So what it did is it came up and there was a crack going up the side of the building that had dropped with the foundation. It tried to get back in the crack, but it had eaten, so it couldn't get in it. And what it did something that I couldn't believe a snake did. And it was about 4 foot long, this bloody big thing. It went up the side of the wall, literally, and followed the crack all the way up the wall and into the cavity and into the brick. And it's funny because I went in the post office. It was a post office building. And I said to the post office, "Can I speak to the manager?" "Yes, I'm the manager." "Mate, I've just seen a snake go in your wall." "What?" I said, "Okay. How big was it?" I said, "About 4 or 5 foot." He went, "What?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Oh, it'll be all right." And I'm thinking, "Only in Texas." Only
in Texas. It's not poisonous, right?
It's all right.
Oh, you kill a snake, you kill a non-poisonous snake around here, you will get a lot of people mad at you.
Yeah, that's it. They are. They're that way, country orientated. And it was in a small town where the bank was on the corner from the post office that had been robbed by Bonnie and Clyde. Wow. And I still remember thinking, because I'm always in a movie set. That's one thing that I realised with Ben, because Ben sometimes looks at me and I'm in awe. And he's going, "What's up with you?" And I'm thinking, I'm in a movie set with no script. Honestly, you know, Bonnie and Clyde, you never hear of these things.
I mean, I've seen in a different bank building. This is in Oklahoma, the bullet holes from Bonnie and Clyde. And they didn't frame it, but they know not to mess with it. They know when people come in to change the buildings and stuff, they know those are the bullet holes.
So there is a lot of history in Texas and a lot of it with the old buildings. So the point being is that being involved in it is absolutely fantastic. You're in a movie set, and it's a pleasure to be a part of it and help the communities because they need all they can get, really.
I would say one of the things that was surprising to me, Al, is that after doing so many years of investigations and restorations with you, is when I started to see the pattern of the evolution of the technology back then.
Yes, yes.
There are these plates, Jilly, that'll come out of the brick and they'll have like one hole, like where they would nail the hole into the truss. It's like they started to realize, hey, maybe we should connect the wall to the roof.
Maybe, just not necessarily.
And you see, it would be like one every 8 feet.
Yes.
It'd be like one nail every 8 feet. And that was them going, changing the world.
It was.
Can you imagine how many people they had to convince to do that one little metal connector with one nail?
One of the things that you do find is that you'll find, like, down in Texas, you'll find lots of German communities, Polish communities, British communities, and you see the different styles of building. But a lot of people in America didn't realize that all downtown was built on a kit that came out of Chicago.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And what it was you got a magazine, and in this magazine, you'd order two lintels, supports, the windows, the corniche, and things like this.
All over the country.
From all over the country, and they would ship it to you. So you put your kit together. But one of the things is with these old historic buildings, is it's all facade. It's a box, it's a rectangle, but it's at the front. And a lot of these were very ornate, very put together. So there's a lot of intricate brickwork that are on the front of some of these old buildings that really make it shine.
But what surprised me was that there was no connection at all.
That's right.
You know, as a young engineer, I remember looking in the first time I saw that, right, Jilly? I was like, oh, well, I'm a structural engineer, and this sure seems like somebody forgot something, you know? And then, you know, after we'd look, you know, you'd say, oh, this happens all the time, you know? And after we'd look, you know, more and more, then you see, wow, this is a problem in the industry. And I remember being on the existing, well, let's see, now that you and I were on the existing masonry committee, but I'm speaking specifically of the empirical.
Yes.
So, Jillian, I don't know if you know this or not, but in 1666, when you had the Great Fire of London, right? Okay. So Sir Thomas Hook, do you know Sir Thomas Hook? Okay. Yeah. Sir Thomas Hook was like the poor man's genius, and he was paid to like to do a discovery a day. Can you imagine having to make a discovery a day, you know, to make money and for the
that
Royal
was like
British.
You too. Yeah. Discovering new things. Inventing new things.
I was never a beer a day. So he was overseeing this massive, like a million people in the city or something at the time, right? And overseeing it, and he had to come up with some rules of thumb. And a lot of these rules of masonry for the centuries before were all based on empirical data that was secret. That's why you had these guilds, right? You had these,
only they knew.
Masons would say, "Oh no, I know how to do a flying buttress for Notre Dame. I'm not going to tell anybody except from the people I've trained, apprenticed to me, you know, and stuff, because they're going to protect me." And corporately, or not corporately, but financially, it protects me, right? I know how to build buildings, and that's where you had these different groups. But he came up with height to thickness ratios, and he said, "Hey, look, I've got to have some basic rules here." But for example, he didn't have anything to do with windows whatsoever. And so those rules were still in place when I was a young engineer and going into these building codes. Yes. You know, I mean, one of the things technically that got me into TMS was mortar, because mortar cubes that people do in testing in the field, people will get a result and they'll say, but over here it says I'm supposed to have a certain strength. And they'll say, so it failed. And I don't know if you know this enough about new construction or when you're doing restoration work.
I don't know about new construction.
Masonry is the craziest industry because the stronger mortar, the strongest mortar is like classified like M as in Mary, right? And then it goes S, and then it goes N as in Nancy, and then it goes O and then K. So you see the pattern there?
Yes.
What it is it's the word mason work every other letter, which is the craziest. But what they wanted to do is they didn't want people thinking A, B, C, D, because then what would everybody say? Well, make it A. And with masonry, with restoration, it's really important to get compatible mortar. And this is one of the things that Mike Schuler specializes in with compatible grout, right, which is a whole nother level.
Oh,
a whole nother
totally different level.
But for mortar, you have to have mortar. You know, that's brick and mortar. That's half of the system, right? And of course, the mortar originally was sacrificial. It was never meant to last.
It was designed to be sacrificial to the brick.
Supposed to be repointing it. And what people would do is they'd repoint lime sand mortar with cementitious mortar, and then water would come in and evaporate. It would soak up all the soluble stuff inside, and then it would evaporate on the surface and leave
some thaw cycle.
But you would see the lime being pulled out of the by the getting wet, and then efflorescence. Yeah. You know where it comes on the surface, so the structural integrity is gone. It's just sand.
Yeah, nothing holding together.
So with the empirical, committee, I would, I guess let me finish on the mortar cubes and then I'll come back to the empirical committee. Mortar cubes, I do want to say that this was actually one of the technical things that got me into TMS you were asking earlier, you know, is that that's actually, those cubes in the field were never meant to be pass-fail cubes like here's a strength you're supposed to meet. It's so different than what's actually in the wall for like several reasons why. And so I actually did a paper at the North American Masonry Conference on this. Al's done papers on lateral strain anchors at the North American Masonry Conference. But the cubes, so ASTM C270 is the specification of mortar, and ASTM C780 is field testing of mortar. And they have a test to make cubes in the field. And everybody says, well, why would we be doing those tests? Well, it's to establish trends. If you have like this large project, you can say, wait a minute, we're all of a sudden losing strength. And then you say, oh, wait a minute, the masons don't understand how to mix this or something, quality control. It's meant to be more of a general indicator. And proving that was very difficult. But I was a big disconnect in the industry. And so being able to help in that regard, that's what kind of pulled me in. But with empirical masonry, you're supposed to use the softer, the ones with less strength, because they're more flexible, they're more ductile, I should say.
Right.
They're not going to crack as easily or be as brittle. So the MSNOK, you know, is an example of the kind of mortars we use in historic masonry, the lower ones, the O and the K type, right? And because they're like lime cement mortar. But with the height to thickness ratios, I got pulled into those, and being on this empirical committee that was maintaining this standard from 1666 is where its origins, right?
Yeah.
And people were using it for concrete masonry. Now, concrete masonry, as most people know today, is hollow. right? It's very different than a solid brick, you know, system, but they were still using height to thickness ratios. Well, the thickness is, you know, the structural integrity associated with that thickness is much less, right? And yes, you have it on the extreme fibers, but it's hollow, yeah. Okay? And so it took a lot of there were a lot of people who knew there was a problem, but, you know, Al and I weren't attending these meetings with an agenda, you know, financially. It was for the help the public, to help the world. You know, we were making money elsewhere. This is all a voluntary effort. A lot of people don't understand that. You're paying your own way to these meetings, you know, when you do it like we do.
It can be an expensive hobby.
It is. But, you know, that's why you build these friendships, because you have people who are just as insane.
Yeah. but one of the things is that with Ben talking about with the mortar, this is how we got around certain things. And he mentioned briefly there about a paper that I wrote for the 14th North American, the 11th North American. But what it was that I sat down with Ben and the boys one time and I said, you know, look, with these historic buildings, what I'm realizing is the front facades are not anchored and stable. Can't we just write a paper? So the guys helped me put together a Masonry Society response paper, and we sort of looked at putting that together. Yeah, very popular. And then a friend of ours, Eric Peterson from WDP, is a good guy. You should write a paper on this. And Ben said you should pursue it, and Mike said you should pursue it. It was a lesson learned, let's put it that way. But when it got published, it was amazing to see. And it's these little things that the Masonry Society do that are making the changes long term.
Yeah, so Gillian, what he's talking about, lateral restraint anchors, when you think about the 120-foot long wall, right, that's 30 foot tall, it's the idea of pinning back that wall to the joists that are perpendicular or parallel.
Yeah.
And Patras plates or some kind of big washer, effectively,
right? Stabilize it.
Yes.
Back, you know? You see a lot of these things because, I mean, when I was on the TMS disaster investigation program, for example, I was chair for a while, I remember going to some of these hurricane investigations and you would see these buildings that basically just unzip, three-story, you know, triple-lithe brick masonry building that would just, like, as at the top, someone just pulled it off the wall because it had no real sufficient lateral anchorage.
Back.
And just educating people want to preserve the buildings. It is really, I think, Al, it is the number one thing, that the world, the America needs to know about those mercantile buildings is that just lateral restraint.
That's right.
Just connect the things that you think are connected. It really doesn't cost that much if you do it as a preventative way.
Cost-effective measures.
Of preserving
you. It's not going to fall down on anybody walking past and create more problems.
Well, it's knowledge, isn't it? It's just like anything. You've got to investigate them. And I think
it's wonderful you were talking about keeping everything safe and making things safe. But what I'd like to say is you're both inventors. Most people you meet probably have no idea. It's not every day that I'm talking with one person who has patented their invention. And today I'm talking with two. Tell us a little about your inventions and what it's like being an inventor. Ben, would you like to start?
Well, sure. I mean, I think a lot of the things we've talked about here today are about the spirit of an inventor is innovating and, you know, trying to solve the problems you see. And, you know, a lot of people do that every day. I mean, the patent process is a much more elaborate, formal thing that it's really not appropriate for a lot of things that we come up with that are just great ideas. I mean, I did do, for example, a design patent on a chess game, you know, that could be, you know, commercial one day, but it's something I did as a kid. And, you know, it's a fun three-dimensional chess game. And there are things like I'm a beekeeper, right? And the way that I do beekeeping with observation windows and not using plastic foundation and instrumentation, I think I'm the only one in the world who keeps bees the way I do, but there are a lot of beekeepers you could say that about. You know, they all have their own innovative way of handling, because the problems are all regional. So I guess just being an inventor, you know, is something that we all are in the walking around the planet in my mind. But you went through the patent process, Al, on the wall tie. And,
and
you want to kind of describe what that's like, you know?
Yeah, I certainly did. And it was funny how it came about, because when we talk about the Masonry Society and we're talking about anchors stabilizing buildings, my patent was to stabilize masonry veneer where the cavity wall ties have corroded to tie it back to the main building. Now, one of the things is that for many years I was a member of the Foundation Repair Association. So what I used to do was get involved in a lot of foundation repairs with masonry. And when I was opening up a lot of the masonry and the brickwork, I constantly started seeing corroded wall ties. And I started talking with the lads and things like this. And I said, I wish I could come up with a patent. And they said, well, why don't you? And it sounds great when you see it on the TV and you say, hey, one day I'm going to get a patent and I'm going to be rich. It doesn't always work out that way. It really doesn't work.
It rarely works out that way
because in your mind, I am the savior of masonry. I've got this one thing that's going to make a change and make a difference. And you realize it's a pattern structure of a lot of it. It takes a lot of components.
There's a lot of challenges going through that whole process. I mean, not only does it cost a lot of money.
The lawyer.
You know, the lawyer and getting the lawyer's attention and time.
Finding the right lawyer, and trying
to convince everybody once you've gone through the whole. First of all, you never know going in if the patent office will approve it.
No,
right?
No. I had to do it three times.
Like David Biggs had a great idea and they rejected it. And you have to get the funding to go as many times as it takes to believe in yourself. You know. I would say that it's a difficult process that's not appropriate just because you have a good idea. A lot of people don't understand that. They ask me about that as someone who's patented things. That I would say, you know, it's one thing having a good idea, another having a good a viable business proposition that would warrant the patent.
It certainly is. But what it does is it drives you on to want to make other ones. But then you realize there's not enough hours in the time.
You've got to stick with the one that you've got.
But
you know, in my job, I work with so many people like Al, right, and people in the industry that are trying to solve problems, and to just give them my thoughts and to help them in any way I can is something I've enjoyed doing. When they ask, I say, okay, well, here are my thoughts if you want to know my thoughts. And I've helped with a lot of people's inventions, and they've gone on to make great businesses, and we've benefited as a society from it. And I had some small part in it, and I get a lot of enjoyment and fulfillment in that process.
So you've got a patent as well, though. I mean, what is it? Mudskipper.
I've got a few.
Yeah, you got a few, and you've got one Mudskipper.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mudskipper, tell us a bit more about that, because one of the things is certainly to do with expansive soil and plumbing, right?
I know that in the masonry world, you deal with the damages from expansive soil all the time, right? And so, without getting too technical, I mean, they can go to the website. It's mudskipper.com. You know, it's a way of isolating plumbing from expansive soil. And, you know, Jilly, you're somewhere in the Northeast, right?
Yes.
Is that right? Okay, yeah. So you're what we call lovingly a Yankee in Texas.
Okay.
Anybody outside of Texas is a Yankee. And, so, you know, you probably don't have as much experience with expansive soil, but I mean, it gets wet and it rises and it shrinks and it falls. And so we have these foundation types that are isolated where they're above the ground. So the ground can go up and down and it won't cause any damage to the slab. It won't cause any damage to the brick veneer. And a lot of the commercial buildings in Dallas-Fort Worth, you know, Colorado, San Antonio, these are buildings that are built like this, or they would be just utterly destroyed, you know.
Oh my goodness.
And so being in the industry for decades and seeing the problems from plumbing damage, like you're talking about,
I
didn't think much of it other than, well, of course it would move. It's connected in the ground. And the slab I'm designing as a structural engineer is up here, you know, and I've practiced as a geotechnical engineer and civil engineer. So I kind of get that perspective more and working in the mechanical electrical space with those guys. But over the years, working more and more, I started to see the picture come together more in focus for me. And so, when I'm looking at, you know, codes, for example, as a structural engineer, I know the codes that I have to comply with.
Absolutely.
But I don't look at the International Plumbing Code as a structural engineer, and very few would, right? And likewise, not many plumbing engineers would think to go look at the structural codes,
no.
You know? And so we all kind of live in our own, you know, worlds. But as I was kind of forced to by working with the projects that I've been on, I started to see that not only is there a problem, but it's a big problem in the industry where it's a public health, safety, welfare issue.
Is it a problem that gets overlooked, though?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because there are people out there that's supposed to, same as with the masonry, apply codes. And sometimes they don't get done exactly right.
Right.
But I'm sure that if you had a few problems with the codes underneath the slab, we're talking about big job.
I mean, it's billions of dollars.
But it's not just that. It can really mess the job up.
Yes.
And I think that as well as because it's not investigating it can be overlooked.
Right.
The implications have got to be a bit crazy, especially with the soil and
You know, one of the biggest things. I mean, I was talking to a mechanical, electrical, plumbing firm that was at a conference, and the guy I'm talking with says, nobody cares about plumbing.
Huh.
And this is public health, safety, welfare. Sure. Nobody appreciates plumbing until the plumbing's broken.
Right? Oh, that's a good one. Same as nobody appreciates masonry until
it's on the floor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Have you seen the one with the fire truck and it all falls
down? Yes, isn't that good?
So it happens. It happens.
It
and you and I, we see that it happens. And it's frustrating. Yeah, I know. But the problem is that it's not just what people realize it is. It's far worse.
Wow.
Because when you have a sewer gas that gets into the building, and I learned all this stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yo, think
sewer
about
gas, you become nose blind where you no longer sense it.
Right.
If you have a long-term exposure, you'll just get sick and you won't know why.
We're talking kids as
talking
well.
Kids in schools, or you have, public buildings.
Public buildings.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, like, for example, Anne, she has multiple chemical sensitivities, She got a gentleman, she got exposed to black water in California, which is sewage mixed in with the water backing up, and of course that got mixed in and into her workspace where she was, and she didn't know it at the time, and just horrific life experience of seeing your body deteriorate, your mind have this brain fog, and not knowing why. She's got a doctorate in microbiology, virology, and immunology.
Wow.
Very smart woman, right? Sharp as a tack. And all of a sudden, was having a problems just functioning, and her muscles were seizing up and pain, what you and I would say today, even you and I would say, what we would call a five pain scale of 1 to 10 is like a really good day for her.
Goodness.
But you wouldn't know it. You had no idea when you met her, right?
With all of this, did they not have codes then?
Well, so there's the codes, like the first code that was published, you would appreciate it historically.
Yeah.
There was because it was the first code published, they said, why do we need plumbing codes?
Huh.
And it had these principles of plumbing.
Wow.
Okay. And so there's like, I don't know how many there were, let's say 20, and like five of them are violated by this concept that plumbing doesn't matter in expansive soil.
Bloody hell.
Right.
I've seen it in Texas. Right. You certainly expand and contract. Yeah. It can cause mayhem.
So there have been 10 independent engineers, right, who have all spoken about this in half a dozen national places. But still, I mean, I'll talk to some plumbing engineers sometimes, and even after like an hour of sitting down with them, they'll say, Ben, I cannot quantitatively, this is I'm trying to quote, I cannot quantitatively defend what I've been doing for decades. And I know this is a public health, safety, welfare issue. And I know that the plumbing inspector has no idea that this doesn't meet code, but the owner wants me to use it.
Oh, that's quite crazy, man. How come that's allowed?
It's frustrating. I do get it as an engineer in a sense of business, but like, for example, this was supported at code hearings, by the International Plumbing Code and the Uniform Plumbing Code. The UPC, when they heard this, they were like, you need to walk off the job if that's their attitude about it,
But it's something that's not seen, and once it's covered, it's not addressed. So it'd be best to address it before, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the cost is pennies on the dollar, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the costs are millions of dollars that these public entities have to spend on just one building.
Right.
That's over the life of the building, because it's like I say, it's not just like you can saw cut anywhere.
No.
These things are designed like a parking garage up in the air, right? Jillian, can you imagine just saw cutting anywhere you want? The thing's going to collapse, right? And it happens that they do collapse.
Yeah.
So to avoid that, to avoid that, you have to dig where you can, according to a structural engineer, and you have to excavate hand by hand, shovel by shovel, to get to the plumbing that's a problem, wheelbarrowing it out of the building.
That's when you
occupy space, you know.
Right. So that's when you've got a problem.
That's why it can cost as much as the life of the building to try to put a crawl space.
Would it not be better to build one before and have it come into code, and then this wouldn't be a problem?
Well, that was why I did the invention. That was the problem saying that we all know the soil's going up and down. Yes. We know the slab is isolated. It's not like the technology didn't exist to fix it. It's just that it was very expensive.
Yes. Okay? Once everything's in place, furniture, fittings, everything, the last thing you want is a lot of guys running through with wheelbarrows saying, don't worry, we'll be back in a minute.
Right. And it's not just, that's just for one. That's just for one thing. You know, if you have a floor drain with a P-trap underneath, I don't know if you know what a P-trap is, Jillian. It's the... So that has what's called a trap seal in there, right? And so if there's a little bit, like half of an inch of movement has caused this kind of damage.
Right.
But at the end of the day, the plumbing inspectors, you know, when you're a building official or a plumbing inspector or any kind of inspector, you have so much to learn. So, I do empathize with them because they don't read the geotech reports. They're not understanding that the plumbing engineer didn't protect the plumbing from expansive soils. Yeah. They just know this is what people generally do. And so they say, isn't that what we do? When I've talked with building officials after the fact, you realize the millions of dollars that they were in damage. You can see the stuff in newspaper articles and all this. And the building officials say, well, nobody told me.
Oh, wow. Now with code, if there is codes, they're going to have to start implementing them.
So the 2024 International Plumbing Code was where this large, group of organizations came together to the plumbing codes and said, enough is enough.
Right.
This is a public health safety issue. You've said all along you're supposed to protect the plumbing, and we're being really explicit by recommending this extra paragraph or two about expansive soil.
Yeah.
And so that's how it got into the code. And my hope is that building officials will see it. And I just know that it takes a long time for people to learn when codes change.
Yes.
And this is not really a change. It's a clarification, right?
Yes.
Because it's supposed to have been, like I said, the first code that got published had these principles saying, this is the purpose of the whole plumbing code, you know. But it's unfortunate that you have engineers that, I mean, don't get me wrong, there are plenty of engineers that do require isolated plumbing. They use my invention. And you don't have to use my invention. Like I say, the technology existed before where you can post install, hang it up above a space, right?
As long as it's got some space.
As long as it's got some space, the space that you expect.
Give it a chance. I mean, come on, if you're not.
You're plumbing a chance.
I was going to say you're channeling John Lennon there.
Don't be a pipe choker. Something along them lines.
So,
there's your new marketing campaign.
Don't be a pipe choker. Yeah, there you go. Well, that's it.
It is frustrating, but that's the nature of the beast, as you know, with masonry.
I do. And the same as I'm slowly but surely trying to change the codes. But as you said, it's a process. But it's a process that's needed for public safety, especially with masonry. And what I'm learning from you, you got your hands full.
Whenever people ask me about Mudskipper like this, I do need to say that the company I work for is ultimately it's Moore Group. It has a lot of different brands.
Right.
Moore Group and I have an employment agreement, right?
Yes.
Where if it's because they're a design firm that does all these different types of design services. So if there's any of the Moore Group operations, that's Huckabee, TSK, E4H, Innovative Engineering Group, any of those four brands or any future brands that they may have. Yeah. Anywhere in the country, if my inventions are used, I don't collect any licensing fees.
Okay.
I don't want to have even the appearance of a conflict of interest. It's not something I'm legally required to do or even ethically, but because I did the inventive work, I paid for all that stuff. It's appropriate to have a licensing fee, but it just avoids any question. It makes it simple that clearly there's no conflict of interest. There are lots of other design firms that are using and specifying it today, and that's just great. It takes a long time for things to transmit in the industry.
To
make a difference, right.
I think it does take a long time. I mean, I'm coming up to 30 years in the industry, and there's times I question my sanity. I really do. But you've come this far, and you can't let the rest of them down.
Yep.
You've come on the journey so far. So our job is to protect it. I mean, mine... I can't go by buildings without looking up and thinking I need it to be safe.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously now you're going by and thinking, well, I hope they did the plumbing right so that can be safe as well.
Something I should mention, I said earlier, you know, there's a difference between an idea and a business.
Right? Yes.
And what's interesting about Mudskipper is I didn't go into it as a business.
Yeah.
You know, I went into it because it was necessary and I had to control it. And all the things I've helped before, I've helped people, they will take a concept that I've got and they'll add to their own concepts. And that's fine.
Yep.
And then they come up with a product. But a lot of times, the things I've, let's just use the word invented. It's not a word we normally use. But you say things that I've contributed to, how things would work, they get changed in a way that they're not effective anymore.
Yes.
Right? Because people don't understand how they work.
Yes.
And this idea with Mudskipper was so complicated. You know, Jillian, we're trying to coordinate the structural engineer, the geotechnical engineer, the plumbing engineer, the civil engineer, and the architect, right? And the building official that has to see all this and trying to get everybody in their separate corners. What I do with my inventions, I say, structural engineer, you do structural engineering. Plumbing engineer, you just do plumbing engineering, right? And same with all the others. Because right now you have plumbing engineers designing retaining walls.
Right.
And they're designing these things where one structural engineer who used to be president of SEOT, the Structural Engineers Association of Texas, saying that they would be 100 times overstressed. That's not 100% overstressed.
Yeah.
That's 100 times overstressed.
Wow.
Okay. Just to show you how off these products are, plumbing engineers are specifying because someone comes in their door as a vendor saying, my product's going to be great, right?
Yeah.
Whereas mine's proven. It's what some people call it engineered. And these things don't touch. And if they're not touching, they can't.
Well, that's a great idea. And I think I'm looking forward to learning more about it and getting involved with it down the line. But it's nice to see that yourself, me, and a few other people that are out there, it takes a team to make a difference. And sharing knowledge like this between us all, it keeps us all aware because we're all having to cover all our bases so much, but it's changing at such a fast rate with technologies and things like this. But if you don't go back to the basics, is what I've learned, then you ain't going to get it forward.
Right.
It's no use building a car with three wheels, you still need four, mate. That's the thing. It is, though, right?
Yep. Amen.
That's it. I mean, you wouldn't go out and buy a Ferrari with three wheels. I'm sorry. But it's going to change, and hopefully. It's been interesting learning about that, though, because it's something that I wouldn't have thought about could be such a problem. And if there's ways to fix it, I'm all for it.
Well, Alan Pettingill and Benchmark Harris, thank you both for sharing your stories and expertise with us today. It's clear you both care a great deal about what you do. The work you do in the masonry restoration industry not only preserves buildings, but helps keep history alive. To our listeners, thank you for joining us on Brick Talk Live. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with others who also like learning about history, engineering, and restoration. Until next time, goodbye.